footprint on the neighborhoods where they live, and Sydney and Burma have actually each year they dedicate a lecture on the Aliyah of Shama, the elevation of the departed Shama of their parents, and we certainly hope that the words of Torah that we will hear tonight will certainly make it possible for the neshamos to get to an even higher level in Gan Eden. We know that people who are doctors sometimes need a doctor, and people who are auto mechanics sometimes find themselves in a position where they need to turn to another auto mechanic. I want you to know the same thing is true of rabbis. Sometimes rabbis have to turn to rabbis who are specialists, and we have this evening an individual who I would refer to as a rabbi's rabbi. He's also a congregational rabbi, but he's also a rabbi's rabbi. He is one of those individuals who specializes in answering complicated questions in halacha, and he is an individual who many rabbis and many lay people turn to on a regular basis from cities across the country with an endless variety of questions. Actually, Rabbi Welch and I go back many years. We were together in Yeshiva Chofetz Chaim, and we developed a Kesha, we developed a bond, which we've been able to maintain a very close friendship over the years. At the present time, Rabbi Welcher is the Rav of Congregation Ahavas Yisrael in Kew Garden Hills. I remember when he took that position. I recall that people just you know, Rabbi Welcher was well known in Queens, so when he took the position of the rabbi of this particular shul, there was a flood of people that immediately caused the shul to mushroom from not existing into a sizable congregation, which it continues to be to this very day. And you'll soon discover why. Also, Rabbi Welcher has been a rebbe at the Yeshiva Chofetz Chaim branch in Flatbush. He's a rebbe with the 10th grade, and working with teenagers is a special challenge in of itself. There's one more role that Rabbi Welcher is involved in that I'm going to mention, and I saved this for last because I think it's a role that's relevant to most everybody in this room, and you'll see what I mean in a moment. Rabbi Welcher used to be the president of the Vad or Rabbanim of Queens. And at the current time, Rabbi Welcher is the head of the Kashrus Committee of the Vad or Rabbanim of Queens. Now, what does this have to do with us? The good news is that right now, we are very hopeful that under the guidance of Rabbi Welcher, the Vad HaKashrus of Queens, which is a very highly respected Vav, is going to, in Mir Hashem, we are hoping, take a very active role in supervising a number of the kosher establishments in Westchester. And I'm using the word hopeful with a sense of optimism. It would be a wonderful step forward for our community to have the involvement of Rabbi Welcher and his Rat HaKashrus. So without any further ado, it is my very great privilege and our great honor to present Rabbi Herschel Welch.
One second, please. I just want to make sure that I'm on the air. Good evening. I'm very, very happy to be here. with Rabbi Zaitchek, an old friend who came up to Westchester. It's already 2 decades that he's active here to teach Torah. And Baruch Hashem, it's a tribute to his character, his modesty, his integrity. In fact, how much he has accomplished. Anyone that knows him, you know you're dealing with an extremely sincere person. So it's a pleasure to be here. And also, he mentioned that this is dedicated by the Pfeifers, as the Nishmas, some of those in their family that have passed on. May the Rabbanu Shalom grant that it be a schus for them, Be'ezus Hashem Yisbarach. I wanted to share with you some measure of the halachic process. If you consider the fact, or as I did mention, that I teach 10th graders. Now, wanting to stay on top of some of the things that they do, so I, when they leave their books around, attempt to thumb through them a little bit, just to keep a little familiarity with the subject that they're studying. It's been a long time since I've been in the 10th grade. And in the 10th grade, they take global history. In our day, they used to call it world history, but only went to school. Now they call it global history. Near the beginning of the book, mentions peoples of the ancient world. And there's a list, a box, there's 3, 4, 5 different, you know, nations of the ancient world. And if you read the list, there's only one that's still on the world stage. And that's your truly Jewish people. And the rest of them, you have to study history books to find out about. You have to speak to archaeologists. But there's nothing living about them. Now, if you consider that the Jewish people, from Avraham Avinu until today, is close to 4,000 years' time. If we consider that, then we'll realize that we've been present through tremendous changes in the world. The world continues to change. And how is it that a Torah which was received by our forefathers 3,300 years ago at Har Sinai is still in effect today? That tells us of the dynamism of the halachic process. That the halachic process is ultimately addresses not only specific issues, but it addresses general principles and gives methods of analysis by which we can consider any situation which arises and judge it by a halachic yardstick. So if we merely considered, for example, fire, in terms of fire, of striking a match, and we would legislate about the flame, but would not discover its principles. So when we came to more modern applications of electricity, for example, we would really be at a loss. But no lesser figure than Maimonides, based on 2 statements, and the Talmud tells us. The Talmud refers to a coal, and that coal is used rather loosely, we put it in quotes, as a coal. It's made of metal. It means a red-hot piece of metal is also considered a coal, as if it were fire. And it's based on a couple of statements of the Talmud. And the Rambam comes to the conclusion, based on that, that if I heat any piece of metal to the point that it becomes red-hot, then I have violated the creation of fire on Shabbos. So from there we come all the way to the 20th century, to the invention of electricity and the incandescent bulb, which works exactly on that principle, that the filament turns hot and casts off light, and that's the glow of the light that we have from incandescent bulbs. So the Rambam is already, by formulating it, not merely in terms of a fire in a physical sense, but of the principles of what the Torah considers fire, has opened up the possibility of analysis of types of technology which did not exist in his time, and certainly did not exist in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. What's necessary is to have very, very great halachic figures, because the easiest thing to know in the halacha is the applied parts. Just you have in math and physics, you have applied and you have theoretical. Now the theoretical at times unexpectedly suddenly relates to the applied. But only the person who understands the theoretical very well can come to new conclusions about the applied. In the world of the halacha, the easiest thing to know is the applied. The things that we do, day in, day out, We have a certain established consensus, what's appropriate, what's acceptable, what's kosher, what's not kosher. We don't have to redefine today in the year 2007 what a kosher animal is. By and large, we know what a kosher animal is, we know what to slaughter it, we know how to prepare it. This is established practice. No, we need great figures of the halacha who understand the theoretical basis of the halacha to turn their minds to new challenges and new situations which did not exist before. And only by the greatness of these individuals and their analysis of the halacha do we come to insight as to what's appropriate, and in time we emerge with a new consensus, a new issue, so we go forward. There were in the 20th century a handful of extremely great halachic authorities who were extremely adept at dealing with issues of technology. First and foremost, the one that lived in our own country was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, lived on the east side of Manhattan, and he had an amazing ability to. His knowledge was so vast, his erudition so great, that and any shaila which could arise, he could demonstrate for us rigorously. The halachic process is not a process of feelings. Well, this is approximately like this, so we'll decide the halacha in this regard. You can sit in the Supreme Court of this country, the U.S. Supreme Court, and you can do such type of things, and they'll become part of the body of law of the country, and that's fine. But the halachic process is a very rigorous intellectual process. Interpretation that you come to has to be substantiated. You have to prove it. You have to substantiate it. And it's subject to peer review, because rabbinic scholars throughout the world will read and critique your positions. And they have to be able to stand the test of time, the test of scholarly analysis. So the halachic process is a very difficult one. He was such a master of the halacha that in any issue which arose, he could show from the classical sources how the classical sources related to every single type of situation. A number of them are very fascinating. We'll look at one or two of them. One is relatively simple, and one is extremely complex. And yet, in his Talmud, in his analysis of the Talmud, they were all there. The first one, which is a relatively simple application, was a question which arose about 25 years or so back when microwaves were introduced. Now, we know we have injunctions against cooking on Shabbos. Well, is a microwave to be construed as cooking or not? Now, you might say, well, at the end, the eggs, the potatoes are cooked, so what should the question be? But the halacha has various formulations. Shabbos is very distinct as a body of halacha from other areas of halacha. Let me explain. For example, if we deal with the laws of murder, what's morally objectionable is to take another human being's life. So the methods by which it's done are less important than the end result itself. If the end result is a human being that's dead, there's something obviously morally objectionable to it. Then we can go back and consider exactly the culpability of the person that did it. Shabbos, we're not dealing with something which is in and of itself morally objectionable. It's a question that certain actions are prohibited on Shabbos. And we can sometimes arrive at the very same result, and one of them is permissible and one's not permissible on Shabbos. Exactly, the result is the same. And for example, in cooking, we have this very readily. The halacha states that if I use fire or anything heated by fire to cook, that's a violation of cooking on Shabbos. Suppose you move to Tucson, Arizona, and it's in the July and August. I had a friend that lived out there in Phoenix, in fact, for a number of years. And it's 120 degrees is pretty common. You know, I came into Tucson one day. I came to Phoenix one day, a few years back, to go to the Grand Canyon, and it was a rather cool day. It was only between 95 and 100 that I pulled in. Now, 120 is not a big deal in that part of the world.
You could actually take an egg, crack it, put it out on a plate outside, and come back a little bit later, and you'll have a fried egg on Shabbos, and it's 100% fine. It would not violate the halacha. That's so doing. Now, what's the reason for that? So, the Rashi, who we're most familiar with, probably from his commentary on the Chumash, but Rashi in the laws in the Masechta Shabbos, which discusses at length the laws of Shabbos, tells us the reason for this is that this was a non-conventional means of cooking, and therefore it was not to be construed as being included in the halachic injunction of cooking on Shabbos. So we start off that we have cooking with fire, and we have cooking by using the sun. One is 100% permissible on Shabbos, one is 100% prohibited. And then we have, there's a middle ground. The middle ground is that if I take a frying pan, for example, and put it outside in Phoenix, Arizona, and heat the frying pan up, and then bring the frying pan back into the house and crack an egg into it on Shabbos, that is prohibited rabbinically. Why? Because at this point, one no longer can differentiate what the heat source was. Did I heat it on a fire? Did I heat it by the sun? Now it's just the hot piece of metal. And therefore, to avoid that confusion, the rabbi said that it's prohibited. But if I put it directly in the sun on a plate, it's 100% permissible on Shabbos. So now, when we confronted something such as microwaves, so is it, it's not conventional cooking, so how should we look at it? Very interesting halacha question. And Rabbi Feinstein, in his analysis, stated the following, that conventional and non-conventional means is gauged by what society will do. And he was very astute. Microwaves are just beginning, and they were relatively expensive at the time. But he said microwaves are used by very few people today, not because the technology is inferior, it's just because it's expensive. He said when the time will come that the technology is going to cost less money, he says everyone's going to have one. So it's undoubtedly that the fact that the technology is a very easy technology to use, and it does its job quite well, that this should be defined as conventional cooking. Whereas the sun, which is a very awkward and difficult medium by which to cook, is unconventional type of cooking. So this is how, based on the classical materials, he approached a new technological issue, which did not exist in earlier times. And he came to reach the conclusion, which has been endorsed by many other rabbinic authorities since then, that this is in fact an activity which is not permissible on Shabbos. Now this is a relatively simple application of the halacha to a new technological phenomenon. There is a question which is much more complex and deals with much more complex material, and as I said, when we deal with life and death, so then the end result is what defines as morally objectionable, much more than the actions by which the ends come about. And abortion is a subject which is very greatly debated in our society, in secular society around us. And I might shock you, but I would not want the Catholic Church to prevail in its fight to impose its view on society, because as much as the halacha to a large extent would agree with their position, but in certain regards their views are antithetical to the halacha. In a very simple case, and stems from the fact that from the standpoint of the Catholic Church, if the fetus endangers the mother's health, that one is still not allowed to do an abortion, irrespective of what the consequences to the mother are going to be. In the halacha, the Mishnah Ovelo states very clearly that the din is that if the fetus should endanger the mother's health, then we have to take the life of the fetus to protect the mother's life. So I would not want to live in a society in which I could not practice my religion freely. And if the Catholic Church would have its way and would impose its laws on the state of New York and the United States, so I would not be able, none of us would be able to practice our religion freely in that case. But I'm certainly not looking for that result. The halacha, to a very significant extent, finds abortion something antithetical to its principles of the protection of human life. But I want first to explore Rabbi Feinstein's analysis of Maimonides and Maimonides' discussion of it, and then to take you to a case where he applied the very same principles which he had derived in his discussion of abortion to a case of conjoined twins, what we used to call Siamese twins, and a very famous case which took place now just about 30 years back. Maimonides states that let me first give you an introduction to our halachic principle. In the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments, we have the halacha of Lois Tzirtzach, the one may not murder. There are obviously exceptions. That is not universal in the Jewish religion. We are not Quakers. We do believe that war is sometimes justified, and we do believe the taking of human life is sometimes justified too. We have a principle in the halacha which states that habola hargach, if someone comes to kill someone, it's hashkein v'hargach, don't sit back, but rather seize the initiative and take his life before he takes yours. So we have the notion that for the defense of human life, we are allowed to take human life. Now we have a halacha which articulates this, which we call the halacha of the rodef. Rodef means someone that's pursuing someone else with the malevolent intentions of murdering him. So the halacha states that the person who intends to kill, that's pursuing his victim, that not only may the victim take the life of the pursuer, but anyone else, any other decent human being who is present and has the ability to protect the victim from the designs of the perpetrator, has the right to use whatever force is necessary to save the life of the intended victim. Now we also have a halacha, and the halacha articulates a principle that we're quite familiar with, really, in the secular law as well, and that if it's nitin latzilo ve'echad me'evarov, suppose I have the means, I don't have to use lethal force. Suppose I'm able to stop him by shooting him in his feet or some other method which will prevent him from doing grievous bodily harm to someone else and still spare his life, then obviously that I have to do so if I'm capable of doing so. So that is the halacha of Reidev. It's one of the situations in which the Torah allows us to take the life of a human being. Maimonides writes that what is the reason that the mother takes precedence over the unborn fetus? What's the reason for that? Now there are... Right, so the Rambam says the halacha is because of Rodev. That's the Rambam's interpretation of the Mishnah. The Rambam says because the unborn child is pursuing the mother, and his life, by his existence, now in the halacha of rodef, of pursuing someone else, is not necessary to have malevolent intentions. What's significant in the halacha is the result, what's going to take place. The intentions of the one that will bring about that result really play no particular role. So if a person's in a situation where he's about to take someone else's life, in a situation which we can say is not halachically justified to do so, certainly, then we may take up to protect the intended victim. Even if the one launching the assault was doing so perhaps without full intent to bring grievous harm, that does not make a difference, intention. The question is very simply that he's doing something which is endangering another human being's life. I would presume from that principle, for example, if we considered, if there was a madman, someone that we would clearly feel has lost possession of his senses, a psychotic. And a psychotic is chasing someone down the block with a knife or a gun. Now, the halacha could not hold the psychotic responsible for what he does. He's a person that's deranged. So we can't hold him accountable. If he actually killed someone, we would never put this person to death. We might put him away to protect society from him, but we certainly would have no halachic justification of taking his life. He's no different halachic than a minor. He's not responsible for his actions. So on what ethical basis would we state that we could protect the victim from a deranged psychotic, from a psychotic who wants to take his life? The answer is because the halachic of Reidev is not dependent on the fact of your personal culpability, that in a court of law you would be found guilty. The fact is you were about to take someone else's life, and there's no justification for that. And therefore, the victim or anyone else has the right to take up against the person who's going to do it, despite the fact that in a moral sense, we can't say that he's culpable. Similarly, Maimonides states that the unborn child, he has no intentions whatsoever, there's no consciousness even. But in effect, his life is pursuing the life of the mother, is going to bring down the mother. That's the Rambam's explanation. The problem with this explanation, and this problem was raised in the 19th century, there was a very great rabbi in Germany, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who was considered one of the foremost rabbinic scholars. His Talmudic analysis is of some of the crispest analysis that we have. And in all the Talmudic academies throughout the world, of all the rabbinic scholars of the last few hundred years, his words are especially studied because his analysis is so rigorous and so clear-cut. He has his mathematical precision and elegance to his analysis. So he raised the following problem in his commentary on the Mishnayos and Ohalos. This is a quote from the Rambam standpoint. He said, the Mishnah also states that once the head of the child has emerged, then one may no longer take the life of the child, even if the child is endangering the mother's life. So he said, so why should that be? If the Rambam states that the child, when he's in the womb, is considered the pursuer of the mother, so why is it any different once he's born? His life is endangering the mother's life. So therefore, on what basis should we state, the halacha state, that we cannot take his life? And he does not answer the question. It's a very, very compelling question. Others learned that the reason that one may take the life of the fetus is not fully considered a nefesh. It's not 100%, even though from the one is, may not take the life of an unborn child, but it's not the same, exactly the same status as a human being yet, in a full sense. And therefore, that life is less significant than the life of the mother. Whereas once the child is immersed into this world and is a full human being as anyone else, then we certainly have no right to take his life, even if that would save the mother's life. It gives us a little halacha commentary from the Mishnah about, first of all, what we would say about partial birth abortions. That we would have a very, very difficult time. You know, beyond anything else, I mean, how egregious it is. I mean, you have a child that's basically born already. It's not fully emerged into the world to take the life of such a child. Yeah, so the question then remains, so how do we justify the Rambam's statement of Maimonides that the unborn child is a pursuer, that he's still pursuing the mother when he's born to. There is a statement in the Talmud, when the Talmud states that mishamayim karat filo, means, would seem to state that the child is not considered a pursuer, because this is not something being done independently by a human being. This is the nature itself. It's playing itself out in this regard. And since nature is playing itself out, it's a heavenly process, it's a biological process ordained in heaven that is not considered rode for pursuer. That one could take the Talmud in that regard and then interpret it, and the question merely is the unborn child's life has a lesser status than the mother itself. But Maimonides does not so explain. The Mishnah, the Maimonides tells us he's considered that he's in pursuit of the mother. So Rav Feinstein offered a very, very interesting analysis. He said the issue is that, and he found proof of this, the Talmud was written in two places. We have, in fact, the Talmud that most of us, if we've ever opened up a page of the Talmud to study it, we've studied the Babylonian Talmud, which was written over a number of hundreds of years in Babylonian Persian. There was, relatively at the same time, the rabbis in the land of Israel also were conducting their analysis of the Mishnah, and they wrote their findings as well, which we call today Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud which was written, the recordings of the rabbis in Israel and their analysis of halachic matters. And Rabbi Feinstein cites the Yerushalmi in more than one place, where the Yerushalmi states that the issue is, once the child is born, that the question is, how do we determine who's pursuing who? There are two people, in effect. Each life is affecting negatively the other life. We have a child, and the mother is in the throes of a very difficult childbirth, and she will die if we don't kill the child. So the child is certainly affecting the mother's life negatively. But on the other hand, well, what should we do? Should we say kill the child to spare the mother? So we're saying that the mother's life is, in effect, casting a negative on the child. So who, in fact, is considered in pursuit of whom? We have two lives which have come to a point where they are mutually exclusive. And to opt for anyone, well, how can we opt for one? Well, there's another human life on the other side. And therefore, the halacha states in such a situation that we cannot take any life. See, sometimes as human beings, the halacha states that all we can do is shava al tasa. We just have to sit back and let things play them out. We don't have the moral authority to make our own decision. He says, whereas before the child is born, he says, the child is considered a lesser status than the mother. And therefore, the mother is not pursuing life in the same way. The child is about to kill a full human being. And the mother, if we give her life precedence, we're taking the life of someone that's less than fully human, than the unborn fetus. And therefore, the halacha would give precedence to the mother rather than the child. Now, this is very interesting in its own right. The analysis is very, very interesting. But about 30 years back, the year was, in the Jewish calendar, was Tovshin Lamed Ches, 5738, which this coming is 29 years back from now. In the Lakewood, there was a person who was in the yeshiva associated with the yeshiva in Lakewood, and his wife gave birth to conjoined the Siamese twins. And both of them could not survive. And they were in a hospital in Philadelphia. And they had to separate them and to save the life of one of them. But what should be done? Is it morally correct to take one's life to give the other a normal life? Do they have a right to do such a thing? And this was written up at the time and later, subsequent to this, in the New York Times wrote about it at length, a very lengthy article about it. And of course, this is a very rare event, a very tragic event when children are born in such a fashion, a very relatively rare event in the world. And it always attracts a great deal of media attention, what exactly the surgical process is, if it's successful or not. From time to time, when it does take place, we know there's a great deal of attention in the media paid to it. And the doctors were supposed to do the surgery, and the reporters were waiting, and the chief surgeon came out and said the operation's canceled for today. So the reporter says, what happened? Why is it canceled? He says, it's canceled for a very simple reason, he said. There are very great moral questions involved in doing this type of surgery, he said. And there is a much far greater expert on the issues of the morality and ethics involved than any of the doctors here in this hospital in Philadelphia. And this aged rabbi on the east side, Rabbi Feinstein. And when he decides that it's ethically appropriate to do the operation, then we will do it. Until such time, he has told us today, we are not, it's not ethically correct to do it at this point in time, and as such, we're not doing it. It is rather interesting. This was a Catholic hospital, so a Catholic hospital had its own ethical question what they should do about it. And their authorities decided that if someone, a rabbi of the stature of Rabbi Feinstein, was dealing with it, they would be more than happy to have him figure out what was appropriate. This is rather, there was, you know, you may have heard Dr. Abraham Tversky. Yeah. And he's been involved a great deal with alcoholism, and he has a center in Pittsburgh devoted to that. So he relates that he had, in fact, a priest, an ordained member of the Catholic clergy, had become an alcoholic, and he was treating him. And he had a problem because he was supposed to drink from the sacraments. And we know that an alcoholic should abstain fully from alcohol. So he suggested to him that maybe that he could use grape juice for the sacraments instead of wine. So So we said he has to go, he has to bishop, whatever, cardinal, if this is permissible or not. And he told him, when he told him that, that our rabbis allowed this to be used for Kiddush on Friday night. So they went and they sent their Shiloh, the Havdol, all the way to the Vatican. And the Vatican said, if the rabbis say it's good enough for Kiddush, he can use it to the Vatican. So eventually, after weeks went by, Rabbi Feinstein issued a ruling, and the surgery was performed, and one child died and one child lived. And there was a lot of media hype surrounding it. And in fact, one of my friends called me earlier today on the phone late this afternoon and said that his father was a rabbi at that time in the Bronx, and he clipped the article from the Times. He says it's in his file someplace. And everyone wondered, like, what took all of this time till Rabbi Feinstein rendered a decision? So what was projected in the media was that it's a very complex matter, and the rabbi, in fact, he left New York City at the time, he went up to suburbia to Muncie to his son-in-law's house, and that he's spending his time, you know, researching the matter. But I believe the reality is, he may have reviewed the matter, but the principles which he articulated in his analysis of this piece in Maimonides, which he writes, that he came to when he was the rabbi and yet in Russia, before he came to the United States. He came to the United States approximately 1937. So 40 years before, the principles by which he would decide this matter were already elucidated. How did he decide the matter? He read the very same. The halacha states as well, and he involved this in his analysis when he talks about the question, the abortion question of a fetus and of the child who was already partially born, that has emerged. There's a statement, unfortunately, in Jewish history that has been relevant too often in Jewish history. And that is, the halacha deals with, Maimonides deals with it at the very beginning of his massive work, the Yarech HaZaka, that suppose that non-Jews come to persecute the Jewish people. And they give us the following choice, the devil's choice. They say, we're interested in killing Yankel. So if you give us Yankel, we'll kill Yankel, we'll leave the rest of you alone. If you don't give us Yankel, we're going to murder everyone in sight. Are we allowed to turn Yankel over to them or not? Unfortunately, a question which has happened way too many times in Jewish history. If it happened once, it would be tragic enough, but it's happened way too many times. So one of the things that we find is the following, that if this Yankel is undoubtedly, he has no chance of escape, if he has a chance to escape, then we certainly are not allowed to turn him over, because we have the principle, we can't give up one person's life to protect someone else's life, even many people's lives. We have no right to kill a person for that, on that basis. If this Yankel will undoubtedly be caught and murdered, then and there's no other way, then there is at least a view in the halacha which allows for him to be turned over to save everyone else. So the question is that from the moral standpoint, we find objectionable not only killing a healthy person, but even a person who is doomed, we're also not allowed to kill. A person who's about to die, we're not allowed to bring about his death any more quickly. And that's also a violation of taking life. So this person, even if they're going to catch him, but they're not going to catch him this second, so he'll live another few days until he gets killed. So what gives us the right to take away those few days from him to save anyone else? So Rabbi Feinstein decided this, said the answer to that question, which was a theoretical point in when he was discussing it, lies in this principle that we just discussed. If there's an imbalance in the life between the two people, if the fetus's life is of lesser status than the mother, then we opt for the mother rather than the fetus. The halacha discusses life in two regards. Life to be lived on a full-scale basis, as every normal human being does. A life that we call chayesha, life where a person's days are limited. He has perhaps less than a year to live through the terminal illness. And that's called chayesha. He only has temporary life that's left. Now, he takes temporary life very, very seriously. But nevertheless, he says, when we compare the two, the person whose lifespan is very limited is not as significant, his life, as the person who has a normal life ahead of him. And therefore, if I have to put those two people side by side, The fact that one person undoubtedly does not have long to live lessens, in fact, he only has chayishol. His life is of limited duration. And that's less significant than the person that has a regular life ahead of him. And therefore, he says, that's the basis of the view in the Talmud, that one has the right to take, to turn that person over, even though I'm shortening his life by a number of days. Because since he does not have long-range life, that his life is then less significant than a person that does. From those are the principles on which he decided the issue of the conjoined twins as well. And as long as they were both viable, so he said that's the same story as in the Mishnah, where the partially born child and the mother's life is endangered, only one is surviving this encounter. We don't have a right to act. What he waited was until one of the child started to deteriorate, one of the children started to deteriorate. But he did not want anyone to know what his reasons were. I guess he was afraid either that they would give him false information, or that maybe somebody would do something, in fact, see that one of them deteriorated. So he held his cards very, very close to the vest, and he waited. And as far as the world was concerned, he was involved in Talmudic analysis, analyzing a problem, which is a very great problem, a great moral problem, but one which, from the perspective of reading his responsa, that he had 40 years before he figured out the answer to. But he was waiting patiently. And finally, what happened is one of the children's health started to fail. So it became clear that there was only one child who could survive long run. And if they waited for the child that was about to die, it would succeed by that point in killing the other child, so it wouldn't be able to save his life. And therefore, Rabbi Feinstein now invoked the principles which he had used in his Talmudic analysis, that one person has a full life ahead of him, and the child whose health is failing only has days. It's a life of limited duration. And when the halacha compares those two, the halacha grants favor to the person who has a life of normal life ahead of him, rather than the person whose life is already limited by a health situation. And therefore he gave, in fact, at that point in time, a decision as to what is appropriate and how that the operation should be performed at that point. So we have a principle which goes all the way back to the question of abortions and what abortions are permissible. The analysis of Maimonides, which is a departure from the simple analysis that the child does not have fully the status of life. And from that development of all the material surrounding that, Rav Feinstein arrived at a conclusion as to what was appropriate for Siamese twins. Certainly a surgical procedure which probably did not take place at all at the time of the Talmud. And there were surgical procedures at the time of the Talmud, that's clear. In the Talmud talks about cesarean section, and the Talmud also writes clearly that the mother in fact would survive it and go on to have future children. In the time of Maimonides, this was total. That the Rambam was found as rather astounding, because surgical procedures were not known. But I guess if we consider in our time of the heinous crimes of Pol Pot in Cambodia, just imagine that people of that ilk had taken over the entire world. All the knowledge of mankind is dependent on the fact that we have universities, that we have, in fact, places that the wisdom of one generation is passed on to the next generation, that scholars teach the knowledge that they have, that the tomes, the great scholarly works, go on from one generation to the next. So we're not always starting from scratch. We're building upon that which came before. But imagine if we went and slaughtered all the educated people and burned all the books, and we did that in Europe. We would not even know, for example, of the Greek classics. We only know about as many of the Greek classics because of the Arabs. The Arab world survived the fall of Rome and all the turmoil which came after that in Europe. And many of the Greek classics survived only in Arab libraries in the Middle East, which was the time, really, that era of the height of Arab scholarship in the Arab world, in the Arab world. And we took many of the works of the Greek scholars, have been translated back, taken back from the Arab copies that we found in Arabic libraries. Not in our own, because the Western world, we know the Dark Ages, they destroyed scholars, they destroyed all the wisdom, the collected wisdom which had taken place before. So we see the Talmud told us that before this took place, before the destruction of Rome, that there was a cesarean section. They obviously had surgical procedures. The notion of anesthesia was unknown in the time of the Rambam. And therefore it was incomprehensible how one would do such a thing. So the principles which were elucidated concerning abortion, expounded upon by the Rambam, and Rabbi Feinstein's analysis of those principles suddenly played a very prominent role in a very contemporary issue of the morality, the ethics involved in operating as Siamese twins. So this is a very complex matter of the halacha, but the profundity of his analysis was such that it made no difference whether it was a question of how to deal with Siamese twins or whether it was the question of the microwaves on Shabbos. The great mind, in its understanding the theoretical basis of the halacha, was ready to engage the world around us, the technological world. Now we have there's a very prominent issue in our society, which our society is debating at very great length now. And the president has a very fixed position on it, and it's a very controversial position. And I'm talking about stem cell research. Now stem cells are very, very important. There's no doubt that from the perspective that we have now, that a great many cures are going to come from a proper study of stem cells. I spoke to a doctor about a week ago. He is an orthopedic surgeon. And people oftentimes, as life goes on, the cartilage in their knees start to wear away. And that's one of the things that he fixes. Now, it can come about that it's a degenerative situation, that the bones are rubbing against the bones and the knee destroys itself. So he says, what do they do about it? If they catch it in time, I was amazed. So they clean out all the debris, and then they scratch the bones inside, cause them to bleed somewhat. And those bones in the knee contain stem cells. And the stem cells cause a regeneration of fibrous material, which will replace the cartilage. And the person, X number of months from the time they do the surgery, will have a healthy knee again, which will endure. That's a simple byproduct of stem cells, which is used actually in the world of surgery today. Now, the fact that we're going to find all types of cures from stem cells, logic so dictates. The question is morally, are we going in the right place or not? When we do things in the world, we can not only look at the benefits. I mean, I might decide I'm going to cure all the cancer patients in the world by taking out a gun and shooting someone in this room dead. You know, and let's say I'm even right in my analysis. If I kill that guy, everyone with cancer in the United States gets up and walks out of the hospital tomorrow cured. It still doesn't give me the right to take out a gun and kill somebody. So before we decide on any particular course of research, no matter how great the benefits may appear to be, and I say may appear, we don't know for sure, but logic so dictates. So we have to know if we have a right to do it. And the president states that from his standpoint, the use of stem cells, which come from, there are two sources of them. One, they are used in laboratories, which are doing in vitro fertilization, and they have fertilized eggs in the laboratories, which are not necessary to be used. And they can take stem cells from that. And they also take stem cells from, as the byproduct of abortions. I will consider both. First, let's deal with the issue of stem cells from what's left over, what the laboratory doesn't use in vitro fertilization. They fertilize who knows how many eggs, and they use a few of them, and the rest are not needed. Now, typically in laboratories today, the protocols are that they keep them for a certain amount of time if the person wants, and at a certain point, I think when the person turns 55 or so, they either tell them, listen, you know, you want us to use them, or whatever it is, and we're going to destroy them, but they don't keep them. They don't keep them forever. Ultimately, they tend to get destroyed. So the world of research wants to take them and use them. So the question is this also to be associated with the world of abortions? That, listen, this is a fetus in its most embryonic state, in the cellular stage. So what is its status? Is this considered a human life or not? The church, I believe, and the president is so similarly inclined in his moral thinking, feels that this is taking human life for doing such a thing. And we should, therefore, we have no right to really tap into that. I do not believe that the halacha so supports such a finding. I'm mean, I've heard recently, I was rather surprised, that a rather esteemed rabbi, who's, I respect him, his views, but he argued that he felt that stem cell research is in fact included in the general prohibition of harigas ubrim, of taking the life of a fetus. And I did not reach personally the same conclusion, because of the fact that from the standpoint of the halacha, the abortion is only after we're dealing with an implanted fertilized egg. As long as the egg is not implanted, there cannot be an abortion. And I had occasion, in fact, to speak to a rabbi from Jerusalem, and he told me that he had asked this question, in fact, to Rabbi Yoshev. Rabbi Yoshev is a rabbi in Jerusalem, whom I know personally. He's close to 100 years old. But we wish at 55 that we had his intellectual strength and intellectual vigor that he has in his late 90s. I mean, I just spoke to him a few months ago. I went to visit him in February for analysis of a new halacha question. And he's unbelievably sharp. Unbelievably sharp at his advanced age. He's considered the greatest halachic authority in the world today. And so this rabbi from Jerusalem told me that he'd asked him about this, and he told him that he does not believe that there's any problem as long as it's not implanted into the human body. And he asked him, he wanted to bring out, for the rabbi that I spoke to from Jerusalem, asked Rabbi Yoshev the following question, because he really wanted to get it exactly to the T. He says, what happens if you have them in your laboratory and the electricity goes off? And because of that, they're all going to get destroyed because, whatever, it won't have the right conditions. Can you ask a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbos to save these fertilized eggs? And he told him, no, you can't do such a thing. There's no beit. Why? Because halachically, they are totally insignificant. They have no significance whatsoever. There may be situations where it would be permissible if a person really needs them, etc., and but the point that he made was that the halacha gives no particular significance to fertilized eggs that are outside the human body. So that's in terms of, this is a very, very central question. As much as we are against abortion, I told you I don't want the Catholic Church to prevail. I'd rather that society restrained itself and that ethical people reached ethical decisions and not convenient decisions. Now, on the other hand, there is one other source of stem cells, and that's the byproduct of abortions. And that's a lot more morally objectionable. There is a very interesting thing which took place. You have the Christian groups in China, which are very heavily persecuted by the Chinese government. And recently, a doctor in Israel asked Rabbi Yoshev the following question. That the world, it's come to his attention that the source of a lot of the organs coming from China is the Chinese government basically murders people on order. You know, if they need a liver, they don't have one, they take one of their victims, and they murder him, and they take his liver, and they sell it on the world market. And he asked them if they're allowed to buy Chinese organs, because of the concern, in fact, that they are taking human life illegitimately to obtain them. And Rabbi Yoshev paskin that it's prohibited. One may not use such organs because we are considered, in fact, as facilitating the murder of human beings. It's rather interesting that this was reported in the Chinese language media, reported the psak of Rabbi Yoshev, that he banned the use of them, you know, where he was asked in Israel about them. They are very sensitive. It's their own families, in fact, that are affected by this, but it was reported in the Chinese media recently. And I think from that standpoint, I think that it is appropriate that we should not be using stem cells derived from abortions as a means of further fostering our research. I believe that we should confine ourselves to stem cells which come from the what's left over after in vitro fertilizations. This is a halachic analysis which is very, very current. The current issues, you know, affecting the world and society around us, which are being hotly debated, the halacha has positions on that as well. There was a great sage, and there were a handful of the greatest sages there were in the 20th century, who are the greatest rabbis in dealing with new questions. I mentioned to you Rabbi Feinstein. He was in Israel, the greatest in the first part of the 20th century was someone who was known by the name Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz of Bnei Brak. Was considered, he died in 1953, was considered the greatest rabbi of his time. And in one of his books he writes that there is no situation that can arise with for which we cannot find the resolution within the halacha. It does not exist. And he was in a unique position to do so, because he was, the range of his scholarly works, he covered not only what was practical in today's world, the laws of Shabbos, the laws of marriage and divorce, but all the theoretical things, the laws of ritual purity, which apply when the Beis HaMikdash stands, the laws of the temple itself. And he said there is no such thing as a question which the halacha cannot address. We have to pray that the Almighty grant us that we merit great rabbinic figures that understand the halacha at that depth, that they have, are able to access the halacha and provide us with that answer. That's what we have to pray for before the Almighty, that we merit that form of rabbinic leadership. So I wanted to share with you just a little bit some of the issues, some contemporary issues upon which the halacha has its comments. So the floor is open for questions if anyone wishes to ask. Yes.
Maybe I didn't quite understand at the very beginning when you were talking about using a microwave on Shabbos. Isn't the big problem using electricity, turning it on?
Let's say I could get around that problem, in whatever way. So electricity would certainly be a problem. We want to know if I have a means of getting around that problem. For example, let's say I want to put it on automatically.
I see what you mean.
Right? So could I put an egg in and the microwave will cook it automatically on Shabbos? Could I do that? They definitely, there's no question that the stem cells in the cord can definitely be used. Now, there is a rising, both in Israel, it's taking place. There are organizations which are trying to get people to donate those stem cells, you know, the cord blood. Because undoubtedly, the cord blood is certainly extremely useful in that regard. And I've been asked, and I tell people, listen, you have every reason that you should put it away. I mean, it could, in fact, mean the difference between life and death for someone in your family, you know, down the road. So it's very, very useful. It's a very nascent state in terms of a movement, in fact, to put it away, but it's already taking place. There are those that are organizing that want to do this in a very wholesale way in Israel, and it's already taking place in the United States now, quite commonly. Yes?
Not exactly.
Usually the psak for such a thing is the following. If a normal human being can live his full life with one kidney, I mean very few people fortunately experience kidney failure other than right before they die, when the body starts to shut down, and that's one of the most immediate symptoms of impending death, is the shutdown of the kidneys. The normal human being proceeds, I say, good, there are people that take ill, but normal human beings proceed throughout their life with one kidney is more than enough to sustain a person. And therefore, the halacha would state the following, that a person is not obligated to do so. We cannot listen. There's a certain minimal risk to his health. The fact that he has to undergo general anesthesia, the fact that he's exposed to surgical procedures, none of these are risk-free. So we cannot state that a person has to undergo risk for that reason. But Allah does state that it's a very great mitzvah to do so. And one that does do such a thing, in fact, has saved someone's life. Now, increasingly what's happening in today's world is because of the fact the shortage of such organs, that people are donating them to other members in their family. I mean, I know someone, in fact, he called me today, he donated a kidney to save his father's life.
I'm talking about the morality issue of taking a kidney from a murderer.
I don't see that as a problem. A murderer needs to be punished. As long as he lives in this world, he's a human being. And he has endowed with the ability to do certain good. I mean, I don't mean to, we should, can't put him on a moral pedestal, obviously, but he's a human being. And he is obligated to do good in the time that he has there, despite whatever his massive failings in this world as anyone else. Yeah.
I don't understand your analogy between Esau body parts from China, where you're saying that they're being killed for the purpose of taking these body parts, and with using stem cells of aborted fetuses, where the abortion is not for the purpose of taking out these stem cells. It just doesn't seem to follow us.
Let me explain. I should amplify that. The halacha generally states that we should not involve ourselves in anything which fosters an activity or supports an activity in any way which we find morally objectionable. And I think from that standpoint, one could argue that the fact that society makes use of the byproducts of abortions in a way gives a certain sanction to abortions, inevitably. That one could say, you're right, it's not exactly the same. But nevertheless, they're not making the abortion because I'm doing stem cell research, that you're right about. But nevertheless, by the fact that we make use of the materials that they provide, in a way gives a certain moral sanction to what they're doing. And to me, it would seem that it's somewhat tainted. But your point is well taken.
I think if anybody wishes to ask Rabbi Welter about a halachic question on a different subject other than the one that Rabbi Welter raised, you may do so, but I have to put, just a little ceiling on this. Rabbi Welter has to teach tomorrow morning, so we definitely can't go past 1:30. If anybody would like to ask you...
Yeah. Rabbi, I just mentioned that